Sozialistische Podcast von Linkswing. Du hörst Aufnahmen von unserem antikapitalistischen Marxismuskongress 2024 in Wien. Ein Wochenende lang haben internationale Gäste und AktivistInnen aus Österreich aktuelle Herausforderungen und Chancen für die Linke diskutiert. Weitere Details und Hintergrundinfos zu den behandelten Themen findest du auf linkswende.org, unseren Facebook-, Instagram- und Twitter-Kanälen und in den Shownotes. Du willst selbst aktiv werden oder mehr über Linkswende erfahren? Dann melde dich auf linkswende.org für den Newsletter an und wir versorgen dich mit allen Infos zu Aktionen, Protesten oder Veranstaltungen. Oder schreibe uns eine Mail an linkswende@posteo.de oder auf Social Media. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit der aktuellen Folge.
Thank you. So, first of all, apologies from Janie Stone. It wasn't just me that wrote this book, but she's in Australia, and it's even further to come to this meeting than I did. So, I want to talk about this book, and it seems from the outside it might be a niche subject, you know, sort of an obscure subject. I want to argue that it's a very, very central and relevant subject for today, for the situation that we're facing now, for three reasons. So it is a book about history. It really runs from 1881 to 1945, 46, 7, 48, but it's actually about the present day for three reasons. First of all, the far right, the rise of the far right. Yesterday, all sorts of meetings discussing that. In the crisis of capitalism that we're facing, the far right need a way of making sense of the world, trying to understand what is happening from their horrible point of view. And that's where anti-Semitism is so important to them, because it's the fundamental ideology of the extreme right, the neo-Nazis, but also people like Orban. If you've heard of the Great Replacement Theory, which is the idea that somehow they're replacing the white population with Muslims, but it's organised by the Jews. All of that sort of rubbish is required for them to make sense of the world for themselves. Because racism, in our country, for example, there's refugees come across the English Channel in small boats. And the government is saying, this is the cause of all our problems. Now, of course, it's not the cause of all our problems, and it doesn't make sense to anyone. Because if a refugee arrives in the country, that doesn't close the hospitals, that doesn't lower your wages, that doesn't create unemployment. But if there's a Jewish conspiracy controlling all of these things, that making it happen, then it makes sense. So that's the first reason the book is challenges. It challenges the arguments about the far right, that there's a Jewish conspiracy, that Jews are manipulating the world. And I'll look at that one. The second thing that it challenges is the idea, and we get this all the time from the Israeli state, that whatever Israel does represents all Jews. Doesn't matter what you think, it represents Jews. And I just want to read from the Declaration of Independence from 1948, May 1948, just over 75 years ago now. And this is what the Declaration says. After being forcibly exiled from their land, the Jewish people kept faith with it throughout their dispersion. That means 2,000 years. And never ceased to pray and hope for their return to it. Jews strove in every successive generation to re-establish themselves in their ancient homeland. So the argument is that basically all Jews have been Zionists for forever, you know, for 2,000 years at least. So that's the second argument that the book takes on and destroys, I hope. And the third argument is the argument that is thrown against us in this room, which is that we are accused of anti-Semitism because we disagree with Zionism. We disagree with genocide. We disagree with the mass murder of Palestinians and killing children, etc. You know, so it looks at all three, and I'm going to quickly run through them. The first one, then, the idea that Jews are manipulating everybody else is completely shown to be nonsense in the book. What it shows is that Jews did not manipulate others. Jews joined in a common struggle with others. A struggle against poverty, against exploitation and oppression. So it's not about manipulating, but actually being part of a common struggle of humanity. It's So I'm going to talk about Europe, but especially in Europe. So that's the first thing the book shows, part of that common struggle. The second thing that the book shows is that far from Zionism being what every Jew thought for 2,000 years, actually, even it was started in 1897, even right up until 1933, it had very, very few supporters. Zionism was not representative of Jews. Actually, the Jewish radical tradition was much more representative, and the Jewish radical tradition was anti-Zionist. So that's the second thing. And the third thing, the idea that you're anti-Semitic if you're anti-Zionist, but if the left is anti-Semitic. If you look, the history of the left is it has always been the core of the fight against fascism, the fight against racism, the fight against any kind of oppression. And that's why it says in the title, the Jewish radical tradition, revolutionaries, resistance fighters, and firebrands. In other words, it's not we are not anti-Semitic, we are the people that fight anti-Semitism. They're trying to turn it completely upside down. Okay, so that's the three reasons why it's relevant today. And the final thing I want to say before I go into the history is that there's a sentence right at the beginning which says, the radical Jewish tradition was the radical tradition, and vice versa. So there's no difference. There's not a special Jewish radical tradition. There's a radical tradition of which Jews play an important part, but along with everybody else. That is the argument of the book. But there is something special about Jewish history, which is that there's an incredible power that comes from the fight against oppression and exploitation at the same time. Because lots of people are oppressed, lots of people are exploited, Jews were exploited and oppressed at the same time. And those two together creates a special explosive power, which the book explores. Okay, let's move on then. And I do have to go back, not quite 2,000 years, but I'll go back to European feudalism. 1,000 years will be enough. Okay, so and we're talking about Europe. The book focuses on Europe. And in Europe, in 1,000 years ago, it was a feudal society, a landed society, agriculture. You had two classes, the lords at the top, the peasants at the bottom, and virtually nothing in between, virtually nothing in between. So who plays that role in between? That role being living in small towns, bringing in commercial goods, manufactures, things that have been made. Who does the commerce? Who does the banking? Because the Christians were not allowed. The Third Lateran Council said that Christians are not allowed to lend money at interest. So, who is going to play this special economic social role? And that is the minority that is not Christian in Europe, and that's the Jews. So, the Jews were forced into, and it wasn't a question of choice, were forced in. That was the only thing they were allowed to do, that commercial, small manufacturing in the towns and banking. And when anything went wrong, you blame the Jews. Anything that goes on in society, you blame the Jews. And I'll give two examples. The first one is the Crusades. So the Crusades, again, it's war in the Middle East. We've been here before. During the Crusades, the fight is against the Muslims around Palestine. They control Jerusalem, etc., etc. The fight is there. But there's a Cold War, if you like, back in Europe. There aren't many Muslims in Europe, so the people that are targeted are the Jews. So there's an ideological war against Jews at that point in time. That's the first thing that's going on. And the second thing that happens is the Black Death, 1346 to 1349. And when the Black Death, the plague, comes to Europe, millions are dying. Who can you blame? You didn't have science. You blame the Jews. Now, one interesting thing about this is that you probably know that the language that almost all European Jews spoke before Palestine came along was Yiddish. And Yiddish is a form of German, so it's a form that you speak. But there weren't many in Germany, there weren't many in Austria. They were in Eastern Europe. The question is why? Because they obviously learned the language here. We'll push these. That's it. Because of the Black Death, 75% of the towns, of the areas in Germany that had pogroms, and pogrom is a riot against, violent riot against Jews, around the period of the Black Death. So the Jews basically fled, refugees, you know, we have them today, refugees fled eastward, and they went to a place called the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And the king at the time happened to be Casimir III, and he needed that intermediate social layer, because Eastern Europe was lords and peasants and no commerce, etc. He needed those sorts of things. He wanted to develop that part of the economy. And so they were welcomed in, still oppressed, but allowed to come in and continue to fulfill that function. So you get a large, large concentration of Jews in Poland, parts of Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, around there, Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Okay, so that's, we can move forward 500 years, and we can get to 1790, because in 1790, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was wiped off the map. Part of it was taken over by you lot, by the Austrians, Krakow, that area. Part of it was taken over by the Prussians, but the bulk of it was taken over by the Russians, by the Russian czars. And so from the 1790s onwards, Warsaw and places like that are under Tsarist control, and the Tsars, being extremely anti-Semitic, said Jews are not allowed to move away from the area they already are. It's called the Pale of Settlement. And so Jews are forced to live, not only they're oppressed, they're forced to live and not allowed to spread throughout the Russian Empire, so they're forced to live in the Pale of Settlement. Okay, another accident of history. Industrialization arrives. And industrialization comes into Russia, and so I should say, by the way, the Pale of Settlement contained 45% of all the Jews in the world. There were some Jews in Romania, and there were some Jews in Italy and France. They were spread. Jews were spread in many, many places. But the big concentration is in this area, the Pale of Settlement. Industrialization moves to Russia. It starts in Britain, France, Germany, etc. It's moving eastwards. And so it arrives in Russia through the Pale of Settlement. That was the first place to industrialize in Russia. And when that happens, you get a class divide. A class divide right across society, but also a class divide in the Jewish community. You get some Jews who are the industrialists and some Jews who are the workers. You get a class divide within the community itself. And you get a class divide throughout Poland and Ukraine, etc., etc. And Russia enters into a revolutionary state because the Tsarism is a vicious feudal system. There is massive social change. And in the Pale of Settlement, you got 12% of the population. They weren't the majority. Jews were just 12% of the Pale of Settlement. But they were both oppressed because they were Jews, but now they're exploited. So they've got that combination of industrial workers exploited and oppressed at the same time. Okay. Moving on to the beginning of the book, because the book begins in 1881, and I'll explain why. In 1881, Tsar Alexander III was assassinated by terrorists, by anarchist terrorists. They thought, kill the Tsar and you'll abolish Tsarism. Unfortunately, that didn't work, but I wish it had, it would have been good. Anyway, so they killed the Tsar. By chance, the night before they carried out the assassination, they stayed in a boarding house, and that boarding house was owned by a woman called Hezia Helfman, a Jewish woman. And that was the reason for a mass wave of pogroms. That's all they needed. And the slogan of the pogromists was, save the Tsar, beat the Jews. Simple as that. I mean, it didn't make any sense. It was also, you know, the social conditions were creating the reason the Tsar died. But that was it. And it's a ridiculous thing, but it's exactly the same as we have today. Save capitalism, blame the refugees. I mean, that's what racism is about. So that means that you get waves of pogroms, and between 1881 and 1917, when the Russian Revolution puts an end to it, not quite because there's a civil war, but between, up until the victory of the Bolshevik Revolution, you have hundreds of thousands of Jews are killed in pogroms. Many more injured, burnt out, lives destroyed, etc. So waves of this are happening. Okay, so out of that you get massive fight back. There's a massive fight back. That's the objective reason for the existence of a radical Jewish tradition. A Jewish working class who are oppressed and exploited and fighting back against a system that's attacking them. But that's the objective reason for the mass movement. There's a subjective element as well, and I just want to talk about three people: Marx, Rosa Luxemburg, and Leon Trotsky. Now, all of them are Jewish, and it's important to say Marx and Engels, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, Trotsky and Lenin. This was not a Jewish conspiracy, but Marx clearly was an important person in the development of the radical tradition. Why? Why Marx? Number one, Jews, as I said earlier, were the most... Jews were the most international community in the world. They were spread, for the historical reasons, they've got a concentration in the Pale of Settlement, but they spread throughout the world. When Karl Marx wrote the founding document of our tradition, the Communist Manifesto, you'll know it ends with, "Workers of the world unite." Written in 1848. 1848 was the year of the nationalist revolutions. It's called the Springtime of Nations. It happened in Austria, it happened in Germany, it happened in Italy, happened all in Belgium. So there's a wave of nationalism sweeping through Europe, but Marx has an internationalist perspective. In other words, being Jewish enabled him to rise above the nationalism that was carrying, but not just him, because it was written by Marx and Engels. So it's important to always stress that. So there's an internationalism there. That's the first thing. The second thing... Oh, I'm going to have to move faster. The second thing is that this is that because of the oppression, these people, and we're talking about Marx, Luxemburg, and Trotsky, they were brought up in middle-class families. They went to universities, and that wasn't common for lots of people. But most middle-class people who went to university went on to be very successful in, jobs, etc., 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 banking, all sorts of things, industrialists and so on. Being Jewish, there was a block. So they had the education, but they were looking at society from the outside, and they were therefore able to analyse it and understand it from an internationalist perspective. So that, if you like, is the Jewish radical tradition. I want to move on now to look at what was the effect of the Jewish radical tradition, and I'm going to just do it through percentages, through statistics. First one, 4% of the Russian population was Jewish, if you take the whole empire. Jews were twice as much in all the revolutionary organisations. So twice the number in the general population. One third of delegates to Bolshevik party conferences were Jewish. The statistic I really like is it's about Petrograd, which is Petersburg, which was the capital of the 1917 revolution. And the 1917 revolution will liberate the Jews, give them emancipation for the first time in the Russian Empire. For the first time, anti-Semitism is made illegal by the Bolsheviks. In Petrograd, Petrograd is 500 miles away from the Pale of Settlement. In Petrograd, only 0.3% of the factory workforce were Jewish. 0.3%. The Soviet is formed, a very democratic organisation, elected by the factories and to lead the revolution. 11 out of the 35 delegates on the Soviet were Jewish. 11 out of 35 were only 0.3% of the population. Now, it's not a conspiracy. They're not manipulating because they took the greatest risk. They were one-third of the people arrested as Narodniks. They were one-third of the people arrested in the 1905 revolution. So Jews are not separate from. They're part and parcel, and they're taking a lead, and they're taking the risks, and they're suffering. But it doesn't stop within Russia because Russia inspired Jews and everybody else right around the world. And so I just want to talk about some statistics beyond that. First of all, International Women's Day. You all celebrate International Women's Day. International Women's Day comes from a strike of 20... It was called the Uprising of 20,000, mainly Jewish textile workers in New York, Lower East Side, New York. 20,000 Jewish women, 6,000 Jewish men, 3,000 Italian women, and 600 or 700 others. So it wasn't entirely Jewish, but it was from that strike that International Women's Day comes. So when you celebrate International Women's Day, you're celebrating women and the radical Jewish tradition and everybody's fight, because we're all part of that fight against oppression at the same time. Okay, The American, since we're in America, 50% of the American Communist Party in the United States was Jewish. They were only 3 out of 120 million, 3 million out of 120 million. One quarter of the international brigades in the Spanish Civil War were Jewish. One quarter. South Africa is the most amazing one, and I might come back to that if I have time. Probably not. See what the chair says. They were 0.3 of the total population, 2.5% of the white population. Okay, so the first trial, the first apartheid trial was called the Great Treason Trial. Half of the whites on trial were Jewish. When Nelson Mandela was put on trial, you all heard of Nelson Mandela, every single white person in the room was Jewish. They were only 2.5% of the Jewish population in South Africa. In other words, their over-representation, their exploitation and oppression combined is a very, very powerful force. Okay, I want to move on very, very quickly to talk about the other current, Zionism. Because I've described the radical tradition. What was the attitude of the radical tradition to Zionism? The Marxists were totally opposed to it. It's a settler colonialist project. We're opposed to it. It's middle-class bourgeois, we're against it, it's capitalist. The biggest specifically Jewish organisation was the Jewish Labour Bund. And the Jewish Labour Bund, as its name tells you, workers, they were revolutionary socialists, but they said Jews needed their own organisation. So that was their sort of separation. They were extremely anti-Zionist. They hated Zionism. And they had a word to describe what they said. We should not run away to Palestine and steal somebody else's country. If you want to fight anti-Semitism, you fight it where you are. And the word they used was doikite. You know, it's a heinous. You fight it where you are. So the radical tradition was totally anti-Zionist. How far did the Zionists get? Well, I'll read you a quote from... two things to prove it. My last statistics, and then... I've still got... I can see that. Yes, the chair was trying to mislead me. One way of measuring, to be absolutely sure about this... is migration patterns. So when the pogroms take place, from 1881 onwards, you get waves of Jews trying to escape, like refugees today, escape the pogroms. And the question is, where did they go? Because if you're a Zionist, there is only one place you can go. It has to be Palestine. Simple. I mean, if you're a Zionist, where else would you go? You go to Palestine. So we can measure how many people were Zionist and how many people were not by where they went. 1 in 27 went to Palestine. The rest went to America, to Argentina, to Australia, to Britain, you name it, they went somewhere else. They didn't want to go to Palestine. So we have an absolute provable statistic that the vast majority were not Jews, were not Zionists for 2,000 years, let alone at all, until the Second World War comes along. Okay, I just want to read you a very quick quote from a guy called Walter Lacour, who wrote... He's a Zionist, but a very, very good history of Zionism. And he writes about the year 1933, and he says, "How little has Zionism achieved in more than three decades?" Because it was established by Herzl in 1897. How little has it achieved in more than three decades? We've not won over the Jewish masses to the Zionist ideas. Of 4 million American Jews, only 88,000 voted in the Zionist elections. In Romania, only 40,000. In Hungary, 5,000 out of a Jewish community of 500,000. German Jews, the majority are actively opposed. In Britain, the majority are indifferent or hostile. Okay. One final thing to say about the difference between the radical tradition and Zionism. When people went to Palestine, Ben-Gurion, who was the leader of the Zionists there, insisted they had to speak Hebrew. Right? They had to speak Hebrew. In 1910, he says, the only language you can use is Hebrew, and he launched what was called the Language War. And the Language War was against Yiddish. It was a cultural onslaught against the majority language that people spoke. At the time he said it, 1 in 400 people in the world spoke Hebrew. 1 in 400 Jews spoke Hebrew. Most of the rest spoke Yiddish. So Palestine was a complete break from that tradition, a smashing of that tradition. But it's not broken yet, because Ben-Gurion can say what he likes. Very few Jews are going to Palestine, aren't they? They're everywhere else, and they're radical. Okay, so what in the end, because at the end of the day, the tragedy is that the majority of Jews did become Zionists. So what happened? And the three things, I think, do it. The first one, in other words, this is the end, if you like, of the radical tradition. Not quite, as we'll see. But this is how it's suffered its greatest damage. The first one was Stalinism. The 1917 revolution produced the greatest hope for liberation for women, for gay people, for all the nationalities of the Russian Empire, but also for Jews, because, as I said, anti-Semitism was made illegal. Stalin comes along, destroys the Bolshevik revolution, the tradition of it, industrializes the country, massive exploitation of the peasants and the workers. He needs a scapegoat. He needs somebody to blame. So he turns to anti-Semitism. So if Stalin is anti-Semitic, then how can Jews look to the tradition of the Russian Revolution? And he claimed to represent the Russian Revolution. And so that was the first real problem. That was a sort of ideological assault on the radical tradition, radical Jewish tradition. The second one was Adolf Hitler. That was a physical assault on the radical Jewish tradition. When the Holocaust begins, there are about 11 million Jews in Europe. Most of them will be radical Jews. He killed 6 million of them, right? Over half of the ones that were here, the Holocaust manages to carry off. So that's a physical destruction. And the final thing that breaks the idea of the possibility of solidarity, should never have been broken, but it was broken, was what all the governments in the world did when Jewish refugees started trying to flee from Hitler. And I'll tell you what happened to people who tried to come from Austria. So, when Hitler arrives and carries out the Anschluss, before the Anschluss, anybody could travel from Vienna or anywhere in Austria to Britain without a visa. Mm-hmm. Right? As soon as the Anschluss begins, the British introduce a visa. So you have to go along to the embassy, stand outside while you're being beaten probably, and attacked and forced to, you know, clean the pavements, and apply for a visa. I've just come from Sigmund Freud's museum. Mm. Very, very interesting. He had Secretary of State William L. Bullitt enabled him to get out, etc., etc. 600,000 Jews applied. 600,000 Jews applied to come to Britain in the period around this time. Only 60,000 were allowed. So the British government on its own condemned, 540,000 Jews to death, basically. But it wasn't just Britain. France, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, the Dominican Republic, Brazil, Colombia, Shanghai, the whole world closed its doors to refugees. And when that happens, the idea that, you know, you can have solidarity with other people becomes a very difficult one to sustain. So in a sense, that finishes off the Jewish radical tradition, and I just have time to do my conclusion, which is the following, that the Jewish radical tradition did not end, has not ended, and you can see it specifically, we are at the anniversary of the Warsaw Uprising. It was very, very recent, 1943. But very interesting, if the book is, I saw it on sale on the bookstall there, but Marek Edelman. Marek Edelman was one of the few survivors of the Warsaw Uprising. And during the Second Intifada, he wrote a letter and he said, "You in the Second Intifada are continuing the tradition of the Warsaw Uprising. You're fighting against oppression, you're fighting against fascism, etc., etc., etc." And so, in a sense, that was the continuation of the Jewish radical tradition. Not by many Jews, but as I said, the Jewish radical tradition is not separate from the radical tradition. And wherever the radical tradition is, that fight continues. And that fight today is around Palestine, is around refugees, it's around all of those sorts of things. So the Jewish radical tradition suffered some blows, but it has not gone away. And there's a particularly interesting phenomenon, and I'll finish on this. I don't know about in here, but in Britain, every single demonstration over Palestine has a Jewish bloc on it. Jewish people, anti-Zionist. And if you look in America, you know, the people, they were in Grand Central Station, they were in the Capitol building, they were all, Jews protesting about what's happening in Palestine. The Jewish radical tradition has not ended. It's continuing. So, the book is about history, but it's not. It's about the present.
Du hörtest eine Aufnahme Aufnahme vom antikapitalistischen Marxismus-Kongress 2024. Wann die nächsten Veranstaltungen und Aktionen anstehen, wofür Linkswende steht und wie man bei uns mitmachen kann, erfährst du auf linkswende.org oder du schreibst uns an linkswende@posteo.de. Wenn dir diese Folge gefallen hat, empfehle sie gerne weiter und abonniere den Marxismus-Podcast, um keine weitere Folge zu verpassen. Danke fürs Zuhören und bis bald.